Hi. Just before you listen to your 3CR podcast, a quick message. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening and enjoy your podcast.
Salam everyone, this is Yusuf. I'm so delighted to be with you again. I will jump into today's topic, which is, you know how everybody is talking about the Palestinian state when our government started talking about recognizing a Palestinian state. So today's episode will be about the Palestinian endeavors, historically speaking, for independence. And I will talk about it from as early as the 18th century and onwards. And of course, I will end to the 1920s. And in next episode, we will continue. Today's discussion will be about the long Palestinian endeavors for independence or statehood or political autonomy. Stay with me. In the 18th century, a Palestinian ruler of the northern parts of Palestine, Al-Jalil, whose name was Zahir Omar Zaidani, managed to create an autonomous regime in the time when Palestine and the rest of the Arab world was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. And he expanded from that part of Palestine to include Akka in the north, and from Akka, parts of South Lebanon, and even parts of Syria, including most, if not all, of Palestine. And he made Akka his capital. He built the fortress, he fortified Akka, and he also built Tabaria and parts of Nazareth. He re-established Haifa port, and for that he was attacked and besieged by the Ottomans. And how he was able to do that is a long discussion. But briefly, he created alliances with other tribes, with the merchants, and with other religious leaders. And Akka became the hub of trading cotton and oil with Europe in exchange for books and other imports from Europe. He used the money, the wealth, into building the neglected cities and towns and villages in Palestine. We spoke about the fortress of Akka and the port of Haifa, but not to also forget that he did invest in building mosques and churches, and he also became one of the symbols of tolerance with other non-Sunni Muslims like himself, especially the Shias of South Lebanon and the Christians of the Levantine. And he is a symbol of the first endeavors in modern history of statehood, not only in Palestine, but in the Arab world. Some Arab historians even argue that Zahir Zaidani inspired Muhammad Ali Pasha, who managed to even create an autonomous regime in Egypt after the failure of the French occupation of Egypt. So that Albanian ruler who was sent by the Ottomans to Egypt to restore law and order after the French occupation of Egypt did the same. He carved out Egypt out of the rule of the Ottomans and managed to create a monarchy that lasted for his dynasty from 1805 until 1952. But his legacy was documented by a Christian Palestinian intellectual, Mikhail Ibrahim Sabbagh. A Christian Palestinian intellectual who was born in Akka and lived for a while in Lebanon and moved to Egypt in the time when Egypt fell under the French occupation towards the end of the 18th century. And when the French occupation of Egypt came to an end, when the Ottomans regained control over Egypt, Mikhail Sabbagh, along with 5,000 predominantly Christian Egyptians who also worked with the French expedition in Egypt, were given political asylum to France. They were sent on ships from Alexandria to Marsalia, and those who were able to read and write were sent to Paris, including Mikhail Sabbagh. So I'm talking to you about Mikhail, another Palestinian historian, another Palestinian intellectual, who played an important role in the beginning of the 19th century, but also his book on Zahir al-Umar al-Zidani was one of the most important books that help understand the reality of the 18th century and how this Muslim Palestinian leader, Zahir Zidani, was seen by the Christian Palestinian intellectual and historian as a hero who managed to create some sort of independence in Palestine. Now, the story of Mikhail Sabbagh becomes even more interesting in France because he started writing about history. He also played an important role in writing about Arabic language. He created a colloquial and Fusha, or standard Arabic dictionary, to translate the slang, Arabic slang or Egyptian slang or Levantine slang, into classical Arabic. He also contributed to making the first French Arab dictionary, alongside the book on Zahir Zidani, the history book. But there is also a personal connection that I have with Mikhail Sabbagh. Me, Youssef, personally connected to Mikhail Sabbagh. And here's the story. In 2010, I was approached by an Australian historian who had access to the exchange of letters between Mikhail Sabbagh in Paris and his fellow Egyptian refugees who had arrived as refugees to France. That historian is Ian Kohler, who wanted to investigate something that happened to this community of refugees 10 years after their arrival. And what happened was, because of racism against them in France, against these newly arriving Arabs, even though that they were Christians, like the majority of French people, but they were seen as, from a purely xenophobic point of view, they were sometimes seen as Mamluks or Arabs or Copts, and there was a massacre that happened in Marsilia, maybe in 1812, where hundreds of these refugees were killed. And there was a tendency by French historians to turn a blind eye or to ignore or to undertone what happened against these refugees. And hence came the Australian historian who wrote a book called The Arab France. Now, part of his research was the exchange of letters between the refugees in Marsilia, the Egyptian Christian refugees in Marsilia, and Mikhail Sabbagh. So he approached me as a translator, and I accepted. I took on that translation project, even though that was challenging on many levels. First level was the handwriting, because I had a scanned copy of the inbox of Mikhail Sabbagh of maybe 100 letters. So to be able to read the handwriting, and the second one, that the level of Arabic language, it contained some words, sentences, expressions that were no longer used, and that has elements of non-Arabic origins that I didn't even know which languages were used. Some of them were slang that is no longer alive. So these 100 letters, the inbox of Mikhail Sabbagh, letters that came to him from Marsilia, of those who were eventually massacred maybe a year or two or five or longest 10 years after they had written these letters to Mikhail, contained a fountain of stories and a very important resource on understanding the beginning of the first Arabic-speaking community of France, and eventually helped the Australian historian Dr. Ian Kohler put together an understanding for his book that was published a year later in 2011. So, of course, there are many aspects we can talk about Mikhail Sabbagh, but I want to remain in the perspective of him being a Christian Palestinian historian who documented the legacy of the first Palestinian endeavors towards independence, which was really way before recent times. We're talking about 1750, the 18th century, at the hands of another great Palestinian leader, Zaher Omar Zeidani. Fast forward to post-World War I. After World War I, the Palestinians, like the Egyptians and Iraqis and Syrians and Lebanese and the majority of Arabs, thought they are ready for statehood, thought the time has come for Arabs to be united under one rule and to live together. I always remember the mother of my father, my grandmother, may Allah's mercy be upon her soul. When she was born in 1920, her father decided to call her Arabiya. Arabiya, that's an adjective, a feminine form of the Arab. In reflection to the spirit that swept the Arab world, the spirit of Pan-Arabism. And when I'm talking about Pan-Arabism before World War I, I don't mean it in its political sense, but rather it was more of a cultural Pan-Arabism, an emotional and social sort of Pan-Arabism. We speak the same language, where we have the same dress code pretty much. We have, of course, a shared perception of history and aspiration for a shared future. And even when we have several sects or religions, we do have one mainstream religion, which is Islam, that coexisted with Christianity and other minority groups of other sects of Islam, like the Druze, etc. So there was a sense of cultural pan-Arabism and unity. And the first layer of renaissance, Arabic Nahda, Arabic awakening, was to preserve the language. So we're talking about the late 19th century. Nahda or Renaissance, Arab Renaissance, was led by Egyptians and Iraqis and Levantines and Algerians and many scholars from the Arab world, whether religious scholars or non-religious scholars. And it was around first revitalizing Arabic language, because this deeply rooted language was suffering the lack of interest from the state. And when the state ignores its own language and it favors other language, for obvious reasons, because the Ottoman world was basically around Turkish language, and there was a sense of ignoring Arabic language or restricting it to rituals, to Friday, to funerals, to Ramadan, to Eid, to pilgrimage, to Quran recitals, to Adhan prayers, to call for prayers, but not the language of the state as it used to be before the beginning of the Ottoman Empire in the 15th century. So after centuries of ignoring Arabic language, there was no dictionary to be able to absorb the new inventions in Europe, in science, in philosophy, in humanities, in mathematics. And the first attempt was, we need to update our 8-century-old dictionary. 8-century-old. And the spearhead of that movement was a Christian Lebanese scholar whose name was Boutros al-Bustani. Not even mainstream Christian. He was Anglican Christian in Lebanon. Boutros started the movement of revitalizing or updating the dictionary, and single-handedly did the first few steps that led to having what we now call modern standard Arabic. But what I want to say is that the early forms of awakening in the Arab world was around revitalizing the language. Because without a language that is able to absorb the new inventions, you cannot make any form of progress on any level. So having attended to language in parallel with attending to the big and heavy burden of illiteracy towards the end of the 19th century by education, there was a generation of newly educated Palestinians and Arabs who led the movement for translation, translating literature, especially Russian and French and English literature and American literature into Arabic. And journalism and building this civil society slowly, slowly. So by the time we made it to 1908, there was some sort of civil society in Palestine, but not necessarily a political project.
Hi, this is Rafif Ziada, and you're listening to 3CR, pro-Palestinian, happily proud radio.
3CR. Here, when we want to talk about the relation between the Ottoman Empire and Palestine and the Arab world, we cannot reduce it to one statement or two. In general, there was no anti-Arab sentiment. There was no persecution of Arabs or Kurds or non-Turks of the Ottoman Empire. There was what the Ottomans wanted from their empire, from their other provinces, basically two things. They wanted stability, which means they don't want to wake up every day on the news of a revolution against their rule in any of these places. And number two is to maintain taxation and cash flow. But unfortunately, they did not, or they ignored two important things. First, infrastructure building, and that included education and health and road, etc., which was very minimal, except towards the end of the Ottoman Empire, when Sultan Abdulhamid II did a form of reformation. There was some sort of investment in building infrastructure, including the railway and many other mega projects, but that was only towards the end of the empire. So they did not invest in infrastructure building, and they also did not invest in social justice. So the Arab world in general for centuries was marked by feudalism, which is a form of injustice that affects the lives of basically everybody except the very small percentage of rich people on the top. So by the time we made it to the beginning of the 20th century, the Ottoman Empire itself was hijacked by nationalists. And in 1908, they forced Sultan Abdulhamid to step down. And the Ottoman Empire kept the reign of control as it is, kept the facade, but it changed its identity into more Turkish-centered identity. And that's when there was tension with other non-Turkish elements of the empire. There was tensions with the Arabs and the Kurds and the Armenians and the Assyrians and the Chaldeans. And these tensions, of course, led into violence. So the recipe of what later became the Arab Revolution, which was led by the Hashemites, was this kind of anti-Arab sentiment in the actual state. And it was, when I say anti-Arab, there was some executions of intellectuals, executions that happened in Beirut and in Damascus of Palestinian and Lebanese and Syrian intellectuals who were hung publicly by the Ottoman ruler of Levantine, Jamal Pasha, who was responsible for this kind of tension and violence that poisoned the atmosphere between the empire and the non-Turkish elements of the empire, especially the Arabs, and especially those who called for any form of reform, who called for any form, not even independence, but they wanted some sort of freedoms on any level. So they were seen as collaborators with the enemy, or they were seen as traitors. So I want to talk about one of those Palestinians who were executed, who were hung to death. His name is Salim Abdelhadi. Salim Abdelhadi was born in Palestine in 1870. And he was one of the very few who received education. And he played an important role in spreading awareness in Palestine, especially to warn the Palestinians from the early Zionist project in Palestine. But because he called for reform in the empire, he was considered as an outlaw. So he was arrested in Jenin in Palestine, and he was sent to Damascus. and he was publicly hung alongside with other intellectuals from Syria and Palestine and Lebanon and Iraq. I also want to talk to you about his daughter, Tarab, T-A-R-A-B. She was 5 years old when her father was executed. And Tarab grew up with the same spirit of resistance and resilience and eagerness for independence, this time against the British colonialism and against the Zionist settler project in Palestine. And it was in her house in Jerusalem where a meeting took place with other fellow women in Palestine under the name of the Women Association, the Arab Women Association in Palestine, that they joined the Palestinian uprising of 1929 Burak Revolution. So to put things in context around the endeavors for a state in Palestine, here we're talking about a build-up of endeavors towards the beginning of the 20th century and post-World War I, and the sense was that we are ready for independence and we are ready for unity with our Arab brothers and sisters in Iraq and Egypt and the Gulf and North Africa. And that is why the Palestinians supported King Faisal, who came to Damascus, and the Syrians and parts of Lebanese and Palestinians and Jordanians and parts of Iraqis pledged allegiance to Prince Faisal and declared him a king, and hence came the Kingdom of Arab Syria, Al-Mamlaka Al-Arabiya Al-Suriya, in 1918. And the Palestinians pledged allegiance and wanted to be in a bigger entity with the Syrians and Lebanese and Palestinians and Iraqis and other Arabs. And they saw in King Faisal a legitimate leader because of his religious connection with Prophet Muhammad and because of their custodianship to the holy places before they had arrived to Syria, but also because of the Hashemite leadership of the Grand Arab Revolution against the Ottoman Empire. Some of the members of the cabinet in that kingdom were Palestinians. For example, the foreign minister of that kingdom was Palestinian, Mohammed Darwaza, who was originally from Nablus. And the speaker of the parliament was Palestinian. So we're talking about full Palestinian support to pan-Arab political entity, which included today's Syria, today's Jordan, today's Lebanon, and parts of today's Iraq, and of course all of Palestine. But it was the colonial powers that brought this kingdom to an end. It was Britain and France who, after defeating the Ottoman Empire and Germany, inherited the Ottoman legacy in the Arab world and distributed among themselves in a secret agreement that was called Sykes-Picot Agreement. So Palestine, Jordan and Iraq fell under British rule alongside with Egypt, which was under British rule anyway, and France took Lebanon and Syria. So when the British Mandate was declared in July 1920, that is when the Palestinian movement wanted a state in Palestine. They said, if independence in a pan-Arab political entity is not possible, then we will be independent in Palestine. And that is the beginning of the Palestinian endeavors for a state in Palestine as we know it, the 27,000 square kilometers. Now, the British troops were already in Palestine from December 17, and it took Britain a year to occupy all of Palestine from December 17 to December 18. And that's when Britain used the Anzacs in parts of their conquest of Palestine. And we can talk later about the involvement of the Anzacs in Palestine. But it was until July 1920 that they declared the British Mandate on Palestine. So to summarize, and here we just made it to the beginning of the mandate to 1920. And in the next episode, we will talk about how during the British Mandate, the Palestinian movement continued its struggle to independence. And we will also talk about the early endeavors immediately after Nakba, the Palestinian government that was formed in Gaza in October 1948. That is next episode. But before the end of this episode, I want to talk about the Palestinian state from the perspective of the Zionist project. Now, for the Zionists, they identified their political project around the state. The earliest literature around the Jewish branch of Zionism, the book of Theodor Herzl, was called the Judenstaat, the Jewish state, which means that they saw the whole project evolving around the core issue of statehood, a state where Jews are the majority. To them, they thought only a state like this can protect Jews from persecution and anti-Semitism and pogroms and violence against them in Europe. And because the whole ideology, the whole political project from a purely Zionist perspective evolves around the Jewish state, so that there is no room in their literature, in their ideology, in their mindset for a Palestinian state. And they will do everything to prevent the inception of a Palestinian state on any Palestinian territory. Not on the 67 borders, not in Gaza only, not in parts of West Bank only. In their eyes, the core of their project will fall apart if there is a Palestinian state. So when they talk about they accept the framework of two-state solution, there is no way that there is any element of truth within their political project for accepting a Palestinian state. And that's why this explains the level of rejection and the level of intimidation to any country that talks about the recognition of a Palestinian state, and Australia is included. And as one example, if you read the charter of the Likud party and their manifesto and the speeches of their leaders, including the current one, including the prime minister in Israel, Netanyahu, they clearly, and they will continue to talk about that there will never be, in Hebrew, in English, and even in Arabic if they can speak it, there will never recognize, there will never be in their eyes a Palestinian state in any part of Palestine. Let's leave it here for this week, and I will continue the discussion about the Palestinian endeavors for statehood and Australia's recognition of a Palestinian state when I meet you next week. Until then, this is Yusuf Ahmed al-Rimawi wishing you the best of times and salam.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.